Day. Senate File 1815, Senator Brown's bill, the Roper bill, and Senate File 962 is a discussion-only Senator Howe's bill. Folks, I have the omnibus pension bill is being voted on at about 4:15 today, so I will be turning the gavel over to Senator Jungbauer, and I'll have to leave early, but we need to get that bill out and going, too. So with that, Senator Brown, Senate File 1815.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members who are here. I have before us Senate File 1815, the right of first refusal. In 2011, FERC issued Order 1000, which did away with a federally recognized right of first refusal. The goal was to incorporate more renewable energy and independent power production into our system. Eliminating the ROFR, FERC argued, would create a robust, competitive transmission line bidding process. However, Order 1000 specifically stated that if states choose to do so, they could enact their own ROFR laws, which many states already have done. There is a bigger issue here, and it's the issue of federalism versus states' rights. Absent ROFR legislation, the federal government will determine what lines get built, who will build them, and to a certain extent, where they will be located. State ROFR laws protect our sovereignty in determining those decisions through our state PUC. Our regulated system has served Minnesota well, and our system is reliable, and our rates are fairly competitive. With that, Madam Chair, I would welcome testifiers.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Brown. We do have the A3 amendment, but we don't have a quorum yet. So that has been passed out. You all can take a look at it. It's a delete everything amendment. And we'll have Rick Evans from Excel and Joe Sullivan. Please come up. Hello there, Mr. Rick Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. In 2005, the Minnesota Legislature, the Department of Commerce, the wind energy industry, the utilities, the Pawlenty administration, all determined that Minnesota needed to start on a program of developing additional transmission in order to strengthen our grid and make sure that it was robust to deal with the challenges of the coming years. At that time, the Minnesota Legislature passed legislation to assist the utilities in putting together what has come to be known as CapEx 2020. And in that time, the last 7 years, the Minnesota utilities have joined together in partnerships through CapEx 2020 and succeeded in developing our transmission grid in a very quick, efficient, low-cost, and reliable fashion. Since that time, we have built or planned 700 miles of additional transmission, and that's just the CapEx transmission. Meanwhile, some of the utilities, including Xcel Energy, have built additional transmission on top of that in addition to the CapEx transmission. There have been hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. And the CapEx process and the Minnesota regulatory process that has allowed that to make that kind of progress has been recognized around the country as a model for how transmission ought to be developed and how the grid ought to be maintained and kept robust in the face of the future demands for energy. The projects that have been completed and as they continue to be completed have resulted in a more robust grid, a low-cost construction, and great cooperation among the utilities. Senate File 1815 effectively preserves the Minnesota regulatory model under which this progress has been made. Under current federal regulation, as Senator Brown pointed out, the utilities have enjoyed the right of first refusal, meaning that if a transmission line is proposed by a non-regulated utility or by a regulated utility, that the two utilities that are connected at either end of that line have the right to come in and say, we want to build that line. That right goes away in July under the Order 1000 that Senator Brown referred to, and what this bill does is restore the system that we've had over the last 7 years that have resulted in such great progress. Maintaining the right of first refusal is important, and I'd like to touch on four reasons very quickly. First, the old maxim, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We have had a tremendous success here in Minnesota in developing our transmission lines and building a robust grid under the current regulatory scheme. To come in at this point and change a critical part of that regulatory scheme for reasons that are not readily apparent, given the progress we've already made in Minnesota, is only going to have unintended consequences for the future. Second, without the right of first refusal, critical decisions on transmission, as Senator Brown said, will shift from state regulation to federal regulation. Opponents of this bill like to argue that this will increase competition, but that's absolutely not true. The only thing that will happen is that somehow the selection process for who's going to build the lines will shift to a federal regulator instead of a state regulator. This is not a situation where consumers are going to get to sit down and decide based on quality and price which product they choose. That's competition. We don't work in that system, as you all know. We work in a regulated system. All this bill will accomplish, all that will be accomplished if this bill fails, is that we will move that system from our state PUC regulated process to some kind of a federally regulated process. And I say some kind of federally regulated process because, in point of fact, FERC hasn't even decided how that process will work. The right of first refusal goes away. That part of state regulation is lost as of July, and at this point, FERC is still trying to figure out how the process will work. When people say, well, it'll be a competitive system, there's no way they can know that because the system hasn't been designed. And it will not be competitive. It will just be a federal regulatory system. The third reason that ROFR needs to be preserved is because of the regulatory compact that we have here in Minnesota. Utilities in Minnesota have a monopoly right within their service territory, that's true. But along with that comes an obligation to serve. We don't have the option of not serving customers that move into our territory. We are required to build and maintain whatever system is required to serve those customers. If utilities are not allowed to build the critical infrastructure that they need to serve their customers, how can we be held responsible for the quality of the service that we're providing to our customers? When power is lost in a community due to a down transmission line that is owned by a non-regulated utility regulated by FERC, who in Washington, D.C. are you going to call to talk about when the power is going to be restored in the state of Minnesota? You could call Xcel Energy, but if we don't own the line and we don't maintain it and we didn't build it and we don't operate it, what kind of responsibility are we going to take for the fact that power is out? And fourth, I'm just going to touch on this because I know Mr. Sullivan's going to talk about this in greater length, and that is that without the ROFR, the cost of transmission to our customers is going to increase. And I'll let Mr. Sullivan deal with that. Minnesota and its incumbent utilities have made great strides in building transmission, in building a robust grid. We've done it under a regulated scheme that has operated in the state of Minnesota for many years very successfully. To change that scheme at this point, it would be a mistake for the state of Minnesota, and we very much enthusiastically support the passage of Senate File 1815. I'd be happy to stay for questions.
Mr. Evans, I think we'll wait until after Mr. Sullivan, and then we'll have questions. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. Again, for the record, my name is Joe Sullivan. I represent Missouri River Energy Services. MRES is a 60-member municipal power agency. 24 of our members are in Minnesota. They're mostly in southern Minnesota and western Minnesota. So to begin, MRES strongly supports everything that Mr. Evans and Xcel just testified to, and we also very strongly support Senator Brown's Senate File 1815. We'd like to thank him for carrying this important legislation. So the two things that I would like to touch on are ROFR for us means continuing local control for us. That is our MRES board. And also it allows us to keep costs low and control costs. So first, like I said, I'm gonna focus on cost. So MRES really fundamentally sees that this issue boils down to the following. Do we want to encourage third-party transmission owners to buy and build transmission service in Minnesota solely for the purpose of passing the FERC, the higher FERC transmission tariff rate on to Minnesota ratepayers? I mean, this is transmission service. It's important that we know that this is transmission service that's going to be built already by Minnesota Utilities. So we feel that we're really looking at a situation where we're going to pay more for the exact same thing. And that's what it boils down to for us. You know, and this is why we support the alternative, which is enacting Senate file 1815 and continue the thoughtful and deliberative process that is Minnesota's transmission planning service. As Mr. Evans testified to already, this is the model for the nation. We don't need to encourage more transmission in Minnesota. The system is doing perfectly well right now. And there's something I want to really focus on, too, and I think it's important that members understand about the FERC rates and their relationship to local control and keeping our costs low. So, first, in the context of today, you know, if our members have a problem with costs, if they, you know, escalating costs, they can go directly to our board and complain about it, find out what's going on, and hopefully seek resolution for themselves, or they can find out the answer to why rates have gone up. You know, if we fail to enact ROFR this year, we're going to move the jurisdiction away from our boards, away from the PUC, towards, as Mr. Evans said, the FERC in Washington, D.C. And additionally, what is actually more important to us is that we do also charge our members we charge our members the FERC rate in some instances. However, in the context of Minnesota Public Power Utilities and investor-owned utilities regulated by the PUC, that higher FERC rate can flow back to our members as ratepayers, as a benefit to them. So the way that I see it is in a sense it acts like a hedge. You know, this is not the case when somebody, an independent transmission owner, comes in and takes the entire benefit of the higher FERC transmission rate and thus bypassing our board's ability to redirect that higher tariff. So, you know, MRES is, as a municipal power agency, we're very sensitive to increased costs. You know, we cannot lessen the impact of large cost increases by spreading them out over a large service territory. You know, our members tend to be smaller cities, regional centers in greater Minnesota. You know, spikes in transmission costs will be felt immediately and severely by our members in southern and western Minnesota. And one last item that I just want to focus on, you know, we're not talking about freezing independent transmission owners out of Minnesota. You know, Senate File 1815 simply gives Minnesota utilities and their customers the first opportunity to invest in federal regionally planned transmission projects that impact their customers. So I'd be glad to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Evans, any questions? Rather two. We may have some a little bit later, though, too. Thank you. Senator Brown, you have the A3 amendment. Members, we have that in front of us. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Ms. Segner and Mr. Garvin, please. Come up together. Yeah, it'll be fine.
Hi, my name is John Garvin with American Transmission Company. Thank you for your time. I've met with some of you before. You've got handouts of my testimony, so I won't repeat that. I just wanted to really highlight a few things that cause us pretty significant concern with this bill. I think at the macro level, people can recognize that electricity does not recognize state borders, number one. And to move right into the bill, the folks before us are correct that last summer there was a significant event on transmission regarding Order 1000. And in that bill, there was an encouragement to seek competition in transmission investments. Now, from our perspective, within that bill, within FERC Order 1000, they did express a lot of respect for states' rights, in particular issues like routing, siting, cost concerns, and so on, and things of that nature. But the thing that causes us the most concern about this is that we find it difficult to believe that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would issue an order of this significance while at the same time offering an invitation to state legislatures to pass legislation that would run completely counter to that. So, as I said, the state PUC has significant oversight over any transmission siting in the state. And so I think that is preserved in many, many respects. But in terms of the overall concept of competition is good for transmission siting, I think that is something that FERC has recognized. And, for example, the legislation that was passed in the Dakotas, that was before Order 1000. So that's obviously grandfathered in. I think it's an open question as to whether legislation that is passed subsequent to Order 1000, where that stands. So that, just in terms of state versus federal energy policy, that causes us concern. And another thing that I think is we'd like to just express is that this is a debate that's taking place in a wide variety of jurisdictions. For example, just this coming Friday, for example, in Carmel, Indiana, the Midwest Independent System Operator, which has oversight over 11 states in the Canadian province of Manitoba for transmission, there's going to be a MISO Order 1000 right of first refusal workshop. So this is real-time activity that's going on in a number of fronts. I'm willing to bet that virtually every utility in this room will have someone at that meeting. And proponents of the bill, for example, we've got an idea that we've developed along with Duke Energy called the sponsorship approach to selecting projects that would apply under what's currently being discussed at the federal and regional level, like multi-value projects, for example. Other proponents in the room of the bill have another idea, competitive bidding. So there's going to be this long conversation about that, and both issues and other issues will be developed. And I guess my point is that issues like this are being developed in a wide variety of venues, and so we think those conversations should obviously continue to take place. And we do see that, you know, state ROFR legislation is a barrier to competition. We are an incumbent utility in Minnesota. The other thing I guess we do want to just point out is that in our reading of Senate File 1815, competition is somewhat situationally positive, because if this bill were to pass as it's drafted, competition in Minnesota as far as building and siting transmission will be significantly more difficult unless you're an incumbent utility. You have to connect to a system that you currently own. And candidly, the flip side of the coin is that an incumbent utility in Minnesota can go outside of Minnesota and compete. So it's, for us, I guess, the competition argument is a little bit situational. So those are really the high-level comments I guess we wanted to bring to the table today. It's just that these are topics that have been going on for a great length of time. And as I said, transmission is a significant piece of the electricity puzzle, so to speak. Electricity, as I began with, it doesn't recognize state borders. You know, we all import electricity from other states. Minnesota produces electricity that goes out of Minnesota. So those are just the comments I guess we'd like to make, and again, you've got my testimony. So with that, I turn it over to Susan.
Mr. Garvin, what do you expect to, at this MISO meeting in Carmel on this workshop, what's the outcome? I mean, is conversations just need to continue on this, or what are they expecting?
Thankfully, that's not my lane. Our regulatory, we've got a whole regulatory shop, like most utilities, and I think it's just everyone are trying to figure out at meetings like this, and there have been stakeholder meetings on this for some time, but I think what people would like to do is to determine, A, what large regional projects may be suitable for some of these multi-value projects or market efficiency projects, for example, just determining what projects might work, and then, you know, how would you apportion costs, for example, and how you would choose the developer. So there's a number of different topics being discussed, and like I said, the workshop on Friday, I'm not involved in those directly. Our regulatory folks are, and they've been in meetings with, like I said, stakeholders for a long period of time, and all the utilities in the room are also involved in those discussions. And as I said, I suspect most, if not all of them, will have someone at MISO on Friday.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Garvin? Thank you. Ms. Sanger.
My name is Sharon Segner, and I'm an Associate Vice President at LS Power Development. We appreciate the opportunity to voice a few of our strong concerns on this bill and to hopefully clearly articulate our concerns and why we are concerned about this bill and very much opposed to this bill. LS Power is a leading player in the independent power industry. We own over 7,000 megawatts of generation across the United States. And here in Minnesota, we developed the Cottage Grove facility here in Minnesota. We have been active in all of these transmission ROFR issues at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And currently we have 500 miles of transmission that's currently under construction in the state of Texas and as well as in the state of Nevada. And we have applied to become and are a state public utility under the state laws of Texas as a part of that process. And so even though there are new entrants coming into this market, the state very much in Texas has control over that because the new entrants are applying to be state public utilities. Basically, this legislation, in a nutshell, steps into the middle of a national debate that has been occurring for the last several years at the federal level. And in July, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ruled that anti-competitive directives, such as a 90-day ROFR, would not lead to just and reasonable rates for consumers. And at the heart of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's ruling was that the existence of ROFR and the existence of just and reasonable rates were not consistent. And so, therefore, ROFRs in utility tariffs all over the United States needed to be removed because it was incompatible with consumer interest. And that is the problem and the issue that FERC was solving, because it isn't compatible with just and reasonable rates for consumers. And so, basically, FERC ordered that ROFRs all over the country be removed, and so regions all over the country are implementing what FERC has ordered. And as the previous witness noted, here in MISO, there's meetings that are going on Friday regarding MISO's compliance. FERC was not alone in their stance to remove the federal right of first refusal. The following organizations stood strongly with FERC in supporting the fact that ROFRs do not lead to just and reasonable rates. For the record, I list off these organizations that supported FERC: the Federal Trade Commission, the Arizona Corporation Commission, the California Public Utilities Commission, the California Energy Commission, the California Department of Water Resources, the Connecticut Department of Public Utility Control, Rhode Island Public Utilities Commission, the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities, the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada, the New England State Committee on Electricity, the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, the Ohio Consumers Council, the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, the Organization of MISO States. In terms of federal organizations that were strongly supporting FERC in the removal of these ROFRs, and including the 90-day ROFR that's being proposed here at the state, would be the American Antitrust Institute, the American Wind Energy Association, American Forest and Paper Association, American Chemistry Council, the Wisconsin Industrial Energy Group, the Project for Sustainable FERC Policy. Basically, this Minnesota legislation flies in the face of this groundswell of consumer support for FERC. In addition, we believe that there is no evidence that the removal of the ROFR harms consumers, and so therefore no basis for this Minnesota-driven legislation exists. There's no evidence that removing these ROFRs harms the consumers. In fact, the evidence is there in the FERC record that the ROFRs, the existence of the ROFRs, harm consumers. Basically, the Minnesota legislation creates barriers to entry. As the Federal Trade Commission wrote very clearly to FERC on this issue. The Federal Trade Commission concurs with FERC's proposed elimination of the ROFR. Consumers benefit from market competition that often takes the form of new entry. In general, sound competition policy calls for competition to be restricted when necessary to protect the public from significant demonstrated harm and for the restriction to be drawn narrowly to minimize anti-competitive impact. And LS Power, as a participant in this market, staring at a potential 90-day ROFR, can definitely say this would impact the type projects that we would propose and be able to build in the state. Now to address specific concerns that may exist about state versus federal issues. LS Power in states like Texas, which has had responded to these issues, basically held a competitive bidding process for the transmission that they needed, that Texas needed to support the growth of renewable energy. Texas had a so-called CREZ process, and in this CREZ process, there were 23 winners of a $5 billion plus worth of transmission. It was competitively bid. What has happened in Texas is that the cost related to new entrants and independents coming into the industry in Texas have been 20% under the cost estimates for what they were initially were. In addition, it has also ratcheted down the rates of return. As the chairman of the Texas PUC said a couple of weeks ago, independents have been a good thing in Texas. And lastly, we would just close, and we appreciate the opportunity to express our strong opposition to this bill. But we would say that the biggest problem with this bill is not about the new entrants. The biggest problem with this bill is that it's bad for consumers. It's very good for the incumbent utilities in the state. It's very bad for consumers. And by giving a 90-day ROFR, it flies in the face of experts at the Federal Trade Commission and other commissions across the country, and basically makes Minnesota into somewhat of an island with South Dakota and North Dakota on this issue, while the rest of the country and states all over the country have weighed in strongly supporting the removal of this right of first refusal. We respectfully submit that there isn't evidence to prove that the removal of this right of first refusal that's been mandated by FERC, that there isn't evidence to prove that it harms Minnesota consumers. And the last thing we would say is that this bill does nothing to ensure that there's cost control for these multi-hundred million and billion-dollar transmission projects. It does nothing to ensure of what the ROEs will be. And for these potential projects, it simply ensures that the walls will be up in the state of Minnesota. If Minnesota is concerned about new entrants and what that means for the process, then a better way, in our view, to handle the situation is to require public new entrants as they come into the state of Minnesota to apply to become a state public utility as part of their CPCN application. We view that's a better option than putting up walls around the state of Minnesota, and that also do not provide any benefit to consumers. Thank you for this opportunity to express our strong opposition.
Thank you, Ms. Signer. I'm sorry I said your name wrong, but that's par for the course in this committee. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Signer, or anybody who can answer it. I guess as we kind of try to look at the whole picture, I guess we can always pit expert against expert. But what I'm really trying to grasp is, as a free market guy, this isn't a free market to begin with. So it's hard to understand, because what it appears to me, so help me out with this, is that companies can come in and build transmission line, and it's kind of like cherry picking. You get the easy part of the job, but you don't have to be here for the rest of the consumers. And so that's what I guess we get kind of concerned about. Is what's your vested interest, and how do we understand that, since you're not responsible for the whole meal deal, as it were, why should we not protect our guys that are responsible for the whole package?
Mr. Garvin?
I would, to that question, I would say that In our industry, we don't own generation, we don't own distribution. So transmission is our, that's the business that we're in. So the transmission system is, that's a place where there is competition available, where it's, that's being discussed right now, how to do it. That's the crux of Order 1000. The transmission piece, you know, that is an area where it's ripe for competition. So as a customer, you don't have multiple sets of wires running to your house. You know, you have your utility provider, and that makes complete sense. But there's been conversation going on regarding energy policy and transmission for a long time. And that's, I guess I would argue that the FERC in its Order 1000 is asking that very question. How do you get more competition? And those are the discussions that, like I said, those are being had right now at the federal, regional, and state level.
Mr. Evans, I will have you come up here too to answer that question in a minute. Ms. Egner.
I would just respond as well that basically FERC was very clear on what was driving them in this federal order, that basically that the existence of these type of ROFRs, whether it's one day or 90 days, it basically was just inconsistent with just and reasonable rates. So how do you ensure that the new entrant is around for the long haul? Well, the new entrant, when they come up with the best idea or the cheapest idea, so that's the only way they would get into a regional plan, is that the new entrant will come up with the best and the cheapest idea, and when that idea goes before the state and the state PUC, then essentially that is the point to weigh in and to be very clear in what the permit conditions are in the CPCN application. And in what Texas required, and again, other states have done it differently, but what Texas required is they said, new entrant, we're happy to give you regulated rates of return, because at the end of the day, that's really what this ROFR issue is about. We're happy to give you new rates of return, but if you want to have regulated rates of return, you're going to have to be a state public utility. And so that is how Texas handled the situation, by saying, look, regulated rates of return are fine for new entrants, but you've got to be a state public utility. And so how that's handled, how it's been handled in other states, is typically part of that CPCN application that goes before the PUC. Essentially, there is also a request to become a state public utility. And LS Power has publicly said that we are willing to apply for state public utility status if we're assigned these MISO-type projects.
Senator Jungbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and a good answer. So just to kind of work on the to complete it a little bit more for me, so I'm starting to get a grasp of this. We are always kind of thinking that the PUC is there to protect the citizens and protect the ratepayers and stuff, and so it appears that part of your argument is that the regulated utilities that exist today are not or are potentially taking advantage of the ratepayers and charging more. So are we wrong in assuming that the PUC understands that and is not somehow protecting the ratepayers in the cost of the transmission lines themselves?
Ms. Egner?
I would say no, I don't think that that's what's being implied here. I think the issue is that competitive pressures bring in different ideas. It brings in different types of technologies into the process. It brings in different types of capital cost structures. It brings in different participants that would be willing to do different things with the cost structure. And it also brings in a willingness, when you have competitive processes, it brings in a willingness to everyone to roll up their sleeves and say, okay, you know, I told you maybe I need a 9% rate of return or 11% rate of return, and maybe we can ratchet this down a little bit. And I think that, you know, for instance, in what LS Power has done in PJM, as we have filed incentive rate cases at FERC, is that we have waived many of those incentive rates, which is different than what some utilities have done as well. We haven't waived all the incentives. We waived some of them.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, I think the difficulty is if you look at the only really operative provision in the bill, it's on line 1.14. An incumbent electric transmission owner has a right to construct, own, and maintain an electric transmission line that has been approved for construction of a federally registered planning authority transmission plan, so on. And so that's the operative provision. What does it mean? And I guess you asked me to ask a couple of questions. One, looking backwards and looking forward. Looking backwards, we're familiar with the CapEx 2020. And if ROFR, did ROFR play a role there? If it existed or didn't exist, what would have been different with respect to who built it, what the rates would have been, what the PUC role would have been? I mean, what changes with or without the ROFR? And looking forward, it would be the same question. If we had a ROFR, and this lady has addressed a little bit, you know, what would be the PUC role? Who would decide whether it would get built? What would be impact on rates? You know, what would be the range? Those questions, I think it's not evident from the language of the bill because the bill just refers to this right, but we don't know what the impact of that right would be. I think that's the questions that should be asked. Looking back, what would have been different if we had a role where we did not, say, with respect to CapEx? Who would have built it? What would have been the competitive pressures? What would have been the role of the PUC? Mm-hmm. And looking forward, if we do or do not adopt this, what would be the effect on rates? Who could compete? What would be the role of the PUC? Yes. Who would decide whether it would be built? I don't think that springs from the language of the bill.
And who can answer that, Mr. Fuller?
Well, we have the witnesses. We have the witnesses, and I guess we should hear from them. Maybe a little more clarity so mm-hmm. that people are comfortable, the members are comfortable as to what this language means mm-hmm. on the ground.
Yeah. So I'd like to have Mr. Evans come back up, please, or Mr. Sullivan, whoever. And maybe we can get to either Mr. Garvin or Ms. Signer. No, that's okay. You can, one of you guys can stay, and we'll do you guys choose.
Yeah.
Hold the short straw.
Well, I'll take the first crack at it. And just, I guess, I would only be looking forward with this answer and say that, kind of repeat what I've already brought up, that issues of transmission that would be contemplated under a statute like this are very large in scale. And so Order 1000, which was only brought onto the books last summer, is still being fleshed out. And we're members of MISO, as are the Midwest Independent System Operator, as are a number of other utilities in the room. And these are all questions that are being discussed in real time right now. Because, again, you've got to figure out first what suite of projects you might be talking about. And the benefit to some of these discussions that are being had on a regional benefit is that the size and the scale of some of these projects that would ultimately be selected would provide regional benefits. They wouldn't provide benefits on a state-by-state basis. But we're all connected to a regional transmission system. So, again, that's another reason, I guess, that I would urge caution to passing a bill like this right now, because these are all conversations that are being had that have impacts on the state of Minnesota, but also outside the state of Minnesota on the regional level. So,
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, more specifically, would the PUC with the ROFR right or without it still have the same role as to deciding the site or the route for transmission line? And
yeah, routing and siting will stay.
Mr. Garvin.
Routing and siting would stay under the purview of the PUC. Because we can all tell you, as you know, as transmission providers and transmission companies, siting transmission is very difficult. And
would the
Mr. PUC, Fuller?
Madam Chair, would the PUC still have authority on the certificate of need whether a line was needed? Would that differ under either of the two scenarios?
Mr. Garvin,
what was the question?
The certificate of need, with or without a ROFR, would it be the same? Would the PUC have the same role in deciding the need for a line?
Ms.
In
Signer.
Minnesota.
Mr. Garvin.
The need analysis. Yeah, the need question would still come back to the PUC. So, as we understand it.
Madam Chair.
So. Mr. Fuller.
Who would be able to compete under the two, with the ROFR and without it, if there was a, to build a line in Minnesota?
Mr. Garvin.
Well, again, those are topics that are being discussed in terms of what suite of projects
Madam
you're talking
I mean,
about.
Under this bill.
I'm not.
Madam Chair?
I'm not understanding the question exactly.
Okay. My understanding is you say you're being fenced out. This takes
we're not.
Very competitive
we're
pressure.
We're not being fenced out. We're an incumbent utility in Minnesota.
Okay. Somebody said
having
you
said
being
that,
fenced
okay,
out.
Having
hold on.
Said that,
hey,
though.
Mr. Garvin, please go by the podium.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Let me put it this way. I heard that somebody was going to be fenced out. I thought that was a testimony.
Ellis,
right.
Ellis,
the lady. And so could you explain to us who is fenced out with the bill and who can do it without the bill?
Ms. Signer.
Sure. My understanding in terms of is how this bill essentially would work is if Ellis Power would come up, let's just say we were participating in the MISO process, and we would come up with a good regional solution that would be low cost and technically effective, because that's the only way we would have it assigned to us. It's essentially MISO would then pick out of many solutions the best transmission project to move forward. MISO would then make that selection, and then at that point, this bill essentially says that the incumbent utility would essentially have a 90-day right of first refusal. Well, that essentially then would mean that LS Power would go through the process at MISO, through the planning process, however it evolves, and it is evolving, but would go through the planning process, and at the 11th hour, after we had come up with this idea and this proposal, that it essentially would be taken from us by the incumbent utility. And then that incumbent utility would then go to the state PUC and apply for a CPCN application for that idea. And so it is definitely locking out. Now, some folks could say, well, it's a 90-day ROFR, and the incumbent utility may decide not to exercise that right. But the realities are, I think it's probably, at least from our standpoint, we view it as pretty unlikely that would happen, because these are regulated rates of return, and these are regulated rates of transmission returns for a life of an asset. And so typically most people want those regulated rates of return. And so basically what this bill does is it sends a message to folks like LS Power that want to come up with good ideas that are cost effective, and says, hey, don't even play in the MISO process, and don't even play in the regional process and come up with good ideas, because at the 11th hour, if they're in Minnesota, we're not going to be able to move forward with them. They'll be taken from us. And so we just have a real problem with that concept. And we think that, you know, by the time that it hits the Minnesota level for a discussion on these transmission lines, we just think it's too late in the process at that point.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Evans a question, and then he can respond to anything else that I asked earlier, which is, I think Ms. Signor said it all comes down to rates. Could you explain to the committee the difference in rates, if there's a right of first refusal and if there isn't, and how that plays out, and whether or not there's more competitive pressure on you to have lower rates if this right does or does not exist?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if an independent, non-regulated utility in Minnesota builds the transmission line, they will be able to charge the incumbent utilities a tariff under a FERC tariff. At least up until now, the FERC tariff has been considerably higher than the tariff, the FERC rate of return that's built into their tariff has been higher than the rate of the return that the PUC allows to regulated utilities. So if the independent company builds the transmission line, they will charge the FERC tariff, and the utilities will have no choice but to pay it. And they will pass that cost dollar for dollar through to their customers, because we have no other place to get that money. What Mr. Sullivan was explaining in his testimony was, we are regulated as to our rates by the Public Utilities Commission. At the time that the Public Utilities Commission sets our rates, they will know how much money we are making from owning the transmission line and what the costs are of maintaining. And so they will be able to set our rate of return at what they want it to be, which has been consistently lower. And so it essentially operates as a rebate back to our customers of the offsetting the money that we've made on the FERC rate of return. So the actual cost passed through our customers would be considerably less as long as the FERC rate of return is higher than the rate of return authorized by the Public Utilities Commission. Now, there's no guarantee that it's always going to stay that way, but the fact of the matter is that the Public Utilities Commission would regulate our rates. That's not going to change whether there's a ROFR or not a ROFR. The only question is whether the cost of the transmission is going to be paid to the outside company that's not rate regulated, or whether the cost of the transmission is going to be brought into the rate case in the whole discussion that's involved in a rate case. I do want to just respond to one other question that counsel asked, and that is about what this means for the future. What this bill is intended to do is preserve the status quo. It's intended to preserve the system that has existed in the state for the last 7 years and more. It's not intended to change the system, which is what the alternative would be. And just to reiterate, I've listened to the folks from the other on the opponents of the bill, and they talk about this competition, and they talk about this federal process. They're having a meeting on Friday to start talking about, gee, I wonder what the federal process is going to look like. To not pass this bill is to cast us into the uncertainty of whatever FERC decides somewhere down the road. Will they decide it by July when the right of first refusal goes away? There's no way of knowing. So what we're looking for is the kind of certainty and the kind of regulatory scheme that has worked in Minnesota well for the past several years, and not trading it off for, well, maybe there'll be competition somewhere down the road if FERC ever figures out how they're going to do this. I've heard how Texas does it. I've heard how California might want to do it. I've heard that, you know, FERC is having a meeting to talk about how they might do it. But essentially, we're being thrown into a system that has not been decided yet. The opponents continue to talk about competition, but I've yet to see where the competition enters into it. FERC could decide, well, we're just going to pick the person who does it. There's been a proposal in FERC I happen to know of that says the first person to propose it gets to build it. Well, that's not competition. That's just a race to the courthouse. So we don't even know what kind of competition we're talking about. We're talking about throwing ourselves into a system that's being designed as we speak, as we're told. Now, I don't want to, you know, sound too parochial here. This is an interrelated grid. This is a regional grid. This is a national grid. Those kind of interconnections are very important. This FERC process is very important. But to preserve the regulatory scheme that has worked so well in Minnesota, we need to preserve the ROFR. And that's what will allow us to go forward as we see if the federal regional regulatory scheme ever actually happens to work out to be anything.
Mr. Sullivan, comments?
Well, thanks. It's hard to follow up on Rick because I completely agree with everything he said. But
okay.
I did want to say there's nothing that I have heard that disabuses me of, you know, I mean, this is fundamentally about who gets the benefit of the FERC rate. There's nothing that I've heard that, you know, that changes that. And I think that it's better, and it's certainly better for our ratepayers that they get the benefit of that as a hedge. And, I mean, that's the only thing I'll add to it.
Ms. Segner, Ms. Garvin, any comments?
What?
I would just add that the place for Minnesota to get involved in the state rate issue is when that new entrant applies to become a state public utility. And as a part of that proceeding before the commission is when that discussion occurs on how there would be reconciliation between the state rate authority and the federal rate authority. And that's where that issue gets worked out. LS Power, when we have proposed projects in PJM, we essentially waived a lot of our transmission incentives that we filed for at FERC. So the net result of those transmission incentives and in terms of what we would be asking for in terms of our overall regulated rate of those projects is actually lower than the CapEx regulated rate of return that's approved at FERC of the 12.38%. And so I would say that it's not clear-cut, quite frankly, the issue on the difference between the state and the feds and how that piece of it would be reconciled. And the place to reconcile that is in the state utility process at the commission when the new entrant applies for state public utility authority.
Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate Mr. Evans' comments. I don't think it's too difficult to preserve the status quo around here. But I'm wondering, Senator Brown, if there's an opportunity to have some sort of a sunset on this or that we review it, you know, to put kind of, you know, something out 3 years or 5 years because we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level and that we'd come back and review it. Otherwise, we're going to be caught in the status quo and saying, well, geez, there's a statute in Minnesota. It's just never going to happen. And so I'm wondering if you'd consider, you know, either a 3 or a 5 year date on this legislation so we could review it as things move forward. We can have another discussion. Otherwise, we won't have the discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Howell, that idea makes sense, but we can do that any time as a committee in the future. We can go back and look at it. We don't have to write it in to this legislation. So I would not favor of that, just for the reason that we can do it in the future anytime we see that it may make sense for Minnesota at that time. But you bring up a good point. FERC process is unknown. It's not. There's nothing concrete here. If we choose not to pass this legislation, we're moving into the world of the unknown versus we have a very known process right now, members, and I think it's best to stick with that process because FERC's process is unknown.
Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Brown, I agree. That's why I'm in favor of your legislation, but only for whether it's 3 years or 5 years, because I can guarantee you it'll be like pulling teeth to bring this back to discuss it regardless of what happens at the federal level. And if we had a date certain 3 years out or 5 years out, then we're ensured that it will come in front of this body for a discussion. You're right. The committee can pull it up any time. I'm just – my comment to Mr. Evans is it just won't come up. And I think it's always good, just like when we do exemptions and things of that, to have a sunset. I'd like to have some sort of a review of this legislation in the future down the road so I know whether I'm here or not, somebody's going to be looking at it. And so I'm just suggesting that. I'm not going to oppose your bill on that basis, but I'm just suggesting that, you know, you could have something in the legislation that would have that.
Any further questions from the committee? Anybody else would like to testify, pro or con? Senator McGuire? We are going to take a vote at 4 o'clock because we would like to get Senator Howe's bill in. And he's got people from home that have come up. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hesitate to ask this question because I actually do feel like I'm informed and ready to vote. But I just wanted to clarify one more time for myself because I think this issue has already been brought up. But is this an issue that the PUC would weigh in on at this point, or do they weigh in after we pass a bill? Or I'm just curious, you know, how they would see this, because I know that when Ms. Sanger read the number of utility commissions in other states that are supporting this, I was curious what our state had done and or would do.
You're referring to the FERC order.
FERC order, right. Mm-hmm. So just was curious what the PUC would think of this.
Well, I don't want to speak for them, but I don't think they want to weigh in on this.
So they don't weigh in yet. Okay, great.
No, I'm getting a no from Mr. Wolf over there. So.
Okay, so that's not something they would weigh in on then, okay?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Well, just following on, we'll just ask Mr. Wolf to shake his head or nod. Yeah. Does our PUC typically not weigh in on these sort of FERC orders? I mean, I know you don't weigh in on state legislation, but a number of PUCs have weighed in in favor of this FERC order, which was a surprise. I just, in our experience, I don't think our PUC has taken positions on federal matters.
You got your bill worked out?
Mr. Wolf.
Madam Chair, committee members, Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Senator Dibble, you're right. We don't normally weigh in on bills before the legislature. It's up to you to make the policy, and we carry that out. We certainly don't have any position on this bill because of that general stance, and also because we would be the body making the decision down the road between an incumbent, between, you know, a non-incumbent, et cetera. So we feel it's inappropriate for us to weigh in on this particular piece of legislation. As to the FERC order, we've not taken a position on that. We, again, to the extent FERC says this is what you have to do, you know, then that has to be done. But we don't have a position on FERC Order 1000. We certainly have had informational proceedings for stakeholders at the commission, but not formed, you know, what's good, what's bad sort of opinions.
Thank you.
And I got a shake from the head no from Director Grant also. So. Okay. Are we ready to vote? Further questions? Senator Brown? Would you like to move the bill?
So, Madam Chair, I move Senate File 1815 as amended.
Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Sent to the floor, yes.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you.
Senator Haupt, Senate File 962. Members, this is discussion only, but I would like to thank his folks from the city for coming up.
Rowdy.
And re-coming up. I know they were here last week and apologize for cramming too much in at one time. So, Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 962. I think we want to focus our discussion here on the pollution control exemption. And I've got some testifiers here that want to talk about how it affects host communities. But in essence, the issue we'd like to talk a little bit about the discussion or the study of the pollution control exemption that was done by the Department of Revenue. And I think you should have that study in your packet. What happens, you know, there's a concern about the effect that the pollution control exemption has on host communities, and in a bigger sense, the transparency of when a pollution control exemption is granted to a utility company. And I think I'll start by having one of our testifiers here. We've got a member from the City Council of Red Wing, Council Member Peg Rader.
Welcome, Ms. Rader. Thank you again for coming up. I appreciate that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I serve on the City Council in the City of Red Wing and am grateful for the opportunity to testify at this informational hearing on behalf of Senate File 962. As a City Council member and a taxpayer in Red Wing, I appreciate the importance of controlling pollution from electrical generating facilities. At Prairie Island, pollution control equipment includes the primary containment and reactor vessel isolation system. We can all agree that's the kind of equipment we want to see at a nuclear facility. We really see this issue as a question of fairness. Generating electricity benefits not only the taxpayers of Red Wing, but the entire state of Minnesota. Yet, the burden of this tax exemption falls on the host communities. It is approximately $726 million in market value and around $12 million in local property taxes in host communities. We believe that if the state has decided that utilities should receive a tax exemption for installing pollution control equipment, the cost should be paid by everyone benefiting from the equipment, not just the taxpayers of the host community. Utilities are required to install this equipment by law. It's a cost of doing business. Utilities receive a subsidy for complying with the law, and the cost of that subsidy falls on the host cities. This exemption has a significant financial impact on the homeowners and businesses in our cities, counties, and school districts. In Red Wing, approximately $126 million is excluded from the total market value as a result of the exemption. This means that the property tax burden for all properties in Red Wing, including businesses and homeowners, is 7.8% higher than it would be without the exemption. As in other cities, the property taxes paid by the utility have dropped significantly over the years. The city taxes paid by Xcel dropped from $5.9 million in 1995 to $4.2 million in 2011. The pollution control exemption, the pollution control exemption only compounds this problem. If the state still wants to provide this subsidy for installing pollution control equipment, we then believe that the cost should be spread to everyone who benefits. This bill would still allow utilities to receive an initial deduction that would be phased out. Costs would then be spread among all ratepayers so that the millions of customers who benefit pay the cost rather than just the taxpayers in the host communities. The impact on ratepayers would be very small. Approximately 1/3000th of a cent per kilowatt hour for Xcel and less for Minnesota Power. There may be other ways to restructure the exemption. We simply believe that if the state wants to provide this form of subsidy to the utilities, it should be done on a statewide basis. The utilities may argue that they already pay too much in property taxes and that instead of removing this subsidy, they should be treated more like other businesses. This argument, however, ignores the significant differences between these regulated industries and other businesses. They enjoy guaranteed service territories and return on investments, plus other powers such as eminent domain. In closing, the City of Red Wing and Xcel have a good relationship, and we appreciate having them in the community. They are excellent corporate citizens. We simply believe that if the state values controlling the pollution associated with power plants, any subsidy for controlling the pollution should be spread out to everyone, not simply to the taxpayers of the host community. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the community, and finally, Mayor, Senator Howe, for your work on this issue.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Ms. Rader, we hear that all the time, too. You know, he's a rock star. We know that. Yeah. Any questions for Ms. Rader?
Mayor.
Mr. Brzezinski. Did I say that right?
Yep. Brzezinski. Oh. Thank you.
How are you? Good
afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come in today and talk a little bit about Senate File 962. I'll be speaking on behalf of the City of Becker, where I am the City Administrator, and I will also speak on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities, of which Becker is a member of. So I'll keep my comments brief, but in Becker, as well as other host communities, we deal with many burdens that other communities don't face. Cities with coal fire plants, for example, deal with issues ranging from accumulation of coal dust throughout the city, heavy industrial noise, increased rail traffic, etc. Cities with nuclear facilities, for example, they face short and long-term issues associated with nuclear waste. They also have unique public safety issues to contend with, planning for nuclear incidents, which, of course, as we know, if something does occur, the consequences tend to be severe and far-reaching. When these plants were sited in communities, the trade-off for hosting a plant would be compensated through property taxes the facility would pay. However, over the years, the share of utility property taxes have dropped significantly due to changes in tax laws and rules, including a lift of the cap on depreciation. As the site of Minnesota's largest coal plant, Becker is one of the host cities that is most impacted by the pollution control exemption. In Becker, the market value of the facility with pollution control equipment is $549 million. The value would be $263 million higher without the exemption. That means the tax burden on all properties is an additional 15% higher because of the pollution control exemption. We are particularly concerned about the future impact of this of the exemption as the as additional equipment is added and the value of old equipment is depreciated and removed from the market value of the plant. Like other host communities, we appreciate the partnership with the power plant in our city. However, we are concerned about the long-term erosion of the property tax base and the effect of the exemption. We believe the state should re-examine the exemption and find a way to spread the cost beyond host communities. Thank you again for the opportunity, and I certainly would be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brzezinski. Hopefully that was... the next person looks like the opposition. Rick Evans, Joel Johnson, Larry Johnston, all coming up together.
Yeah.
Welcome. Which of you would like to speak first?
Maybe I'll start, Mr. Chair. Rick Evans with XL Energy. I do have some handouts I'd like to distribute to the committee, if that
is perfectly acceptable, okay. Mr. Evans.
I'll give Senator Howe a set here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. One of the sheets that we're handing out is really a list of a fact sheet about the property taxes that are paid by utilities and XL Energy particularly, and the pollution control exemption. And it's actually not a summary of my testimony. My testimony will be a summary of that sheet. The other one that I will talk a little bit about is the graph, and I'll get to that in a moment. First of all, to address the idea of a subsidy, which I think is, from our point of view, is kind of a peculiar way to frame this issue. Back before, I think, 1974, all businesses in the state of Minnesota, every one of them, paid personal property tax on their equipment and the equipment in their buildings and on their land. In 1974, the state repealed the personal property tax. If you will, they gave every business in the state an exemption from the personal property tax, a 100% exemption from the personal property tax in 1974. But not every business. Utility companies and pipeline companies, those two companies didn't get any exemption to the personal property tax except the pollution control exemption. So if you made chemicals, if you made shoes, if you made steel, if you made anything else, your personal property tax went from whatever it was to zero. If you were a utility company, your personal property tax was reduced slightly to the degree that your property included pollution control. So if indeed the exemption from personal property tax on pollution control equipment is a subsidy to XL Energy, then I would submit that the entire state of Minnesota is providing a subsidy to every business in the state of Minnesota because of the personal property tax repeal in 1974. The other thing that is exempt is for the last 20 years, when new gas plants have been built, it has been routine for the state of Minnesota legislature to pass an exemption from the personal property tax. That was to encourage the location of plants and the building of primarily gas plants around the state of Minnesota. So the trend in Minnesota law has been to exempt property from the personal property tax, not increase the personal property tax. And the personal property tax that we pay, which I'm not here to complain about or ask that it be repealed or ask that it be reduced, is considerable, and I would ask you to take a look at the chart that we passed out. The blue line at the bottom of the chart over the years listed there from 76 to 2013, which is an estimate obviously out into the future, represents the real property tax that we pay. Any other business in the state of Minnesota that owned property of a similar value to our property will pay that real property tax. We all pay it. The red line above that represents the total property tax that XL Energy pays in the state of Minnesota. So the difference between those two lines represents the personal property tax, from which every other kind of business in the state is exempt, that we pay. And as you can see, it's moved around quite a bit. But as you see at the tail end, it is increasing dramatically without removing the pollution control exemption, without raising the rates. Why is that? Because we're making significant investments in our power plants. For example, the city of Red Wing, and I must say I've known Ms. Rader for 35 years. We're very good friends, and so I hate to be up here testifying on the other side of an issue with her. But I will say that between now and 2017, the amount of personal property tax that we're going to pay to the city of Red Wing will double. It will double without changing any law, without removing any exemptions. And the reason it will double is because we're investing millions and millions of dollars in that plant to repower it and to uprate it. And every one of those new pieces of equipment that goes in will be taxed at its value when it goes in. Now, I know it is difficult for the cities, the host cities, because their revenue stream is tied to personal property. And the reason that's difficult is because, unlike real property, except for maybe the last few years, personal property depreciates. And so you can see this line does move around quite a bit. We add new equipment, and then equipment depreciates. So it is not a nice, solid, flat line. We've worked with some of our host committees to communities to see if they want to, you know, change this so that they could get a nice, flat, predictable source of revenue. But the fact of the matter is we pay a significant amount. Again, the difference between the blue line and the red line is the amount we pay in personal property tax to our host communities, and that number is going up. So I think that, frankly, the question that we maybe ought to ask is, if we want to sit down and try to quantify what the added burdens are on the host communities by virtue of the plants being there, and determine a fair tax that would compensate them for those costs, that would be one way to go. But it's not the way we've gone. What we've done is we've attached the extra tax for these communities to the personal property. And removing the exemption isn't going to solve the problem of it moving up and down. It's just going to increase the tax. In the case of XL Energy, by about $12 million a year, a cost that will be borne by all of our customers. So I think this is a good conversation to have. We've had it for, you know, a number of years with Senator Howe, and we've had it with a number of members of the legislature before that. I think we can continue to talk about this. It is an important issue. But from our point of view, removing this exemption is not the way to address the problems that the cities are having with their finances.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just to address a couple of issues that Mr. Evans brought up. You know, I think the study shows that it's about 11.8 million statewide, not just Excel, but I know numbers change. But the utility industry, you look at this chart, and the utility industry is a little different. It's a regulated business. It's a legalized monopoly in our state, and they have guaranteed profits. They go in front of the PUC, and it's adjusted. And when we talk about one of the issues that we need to deal with on this pollution control exemption is the transparency issue. And I think if you look to page 8 of the report, the executive summary, you know, there's some administrative recommendations. Number one, the original pollution control application and orders should be matched against the current annual tax returns filed by the utility companies to determine if any problems exist in reporting. Two, currently there is no process established to verify that pollution control equipment is still in use. Three, currently the pollution control approval process usually takes more than 1 year to complete. And I'd say that when we talk about taxation, there was a Department of Revenue change in the valuation of utility companies, and I think that dramatically impacted the way local communities and host communities were affected. And so I don't think that the local units of government have the power, or shall I say they lack the resources, to challenge these exemptions that are granted. There needs to be some improvement in it, and it's not saying that if we don't want to increase the rate of the electric cost, and I think we do have a chart that we can talk later about on that, there's another way to do that, whether it's an income credit approach or whether it's through the state statewide business tax. So there's another way rather than making the host community, because if it's truly pollution control equipment and it truly benefits everybody in our state, probably people that don't even live in our state. But if it truly is benefiting everybody, it shouldn't be the burden of the host community, of the school district, of the city, the municipality, or of the county. So I just wanted to respond to a couple of those comments.
Any questions, members? If not, who's going to be next?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Lori Johnson, the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Just a couple comments I'll make. I think you have something in your packet. I was traveling in Washington on Thursday and thought this was going to come up, and so I wanted to make a couple comments. So I'm just going to make a couple points about that. But most of you are used to someone from SEMPA being around here, and so you do understand us fairly well. But we're a little bit different in the construct in that SEMPA and its 18 member municipal utilities are not-for-profit municipal utilities. And so when we look at something like this, I guess there's a couple interesting things that occur to us. One is there's clearly nowhere else for us to push any change in that cost structure than directly through to the constituent residents of the communities that we serve. In our particular case, taking a quick look at the changes, we're probably in the $3 to $4 million range in terms of the impact on that. For an agency the size of ours, that is significant. I guess we have both the good fortune and in this case maybe a little bit troubling situation of having pretty much all our eggs in a basket at Sherco 3, which happens to have a tremendous amount of pollution control equipment tied to it, which is, as you well put, is both good. It's a good thing, okay? And so we find ourselves in kind of a peculiar position here in that, you know, we understand the budget issues of municipalities. I mean, every one of the members that we serve is a municipality, and they're going through the same sort of budget crunches and balancing budgets that every one of the host communities is going through. In our particular case here, we would make up the difference and simply put that into the retail mix with the retail customers on our system, the same people who are going through as consumers with the property tax in those communities trying to balance their budget. So it's a little bit different for us. One of the things we struggle with a bit is simply the timing on this. I mean, even, in addition to the points that Mr. Evans has made, I was in Washington on Thursday, and I was there because I was dealing with what could only be described as a plethora of EPA regulations that are coming down fast and furious on electric utilities. You've probably heard the phrase, the so-called train wreck scenario. And I guess I would just scratch my head just a little bit. You know, maybe there's a different formula and a different methodology, but, you know, Mr. Evans indicated as well that we're making tremendous investments in these plants. And if we can read where EPA is headed with this, we're not going to be making fewer investments. We're going to be making more investments. Frankly, nationwide, the concern is, will some of these investments, in fact, obsolete some of these plants and shutter these plants and take some of them out of existence? So I guess the major points are, you know, we're not for profit. We're a little different. We're dealing with the same constituent groups that are wrestling with their budgets locally, and we think the timing of this is quite difficult as we look towards these requirements of EPA.
Thank you, Mr. Johnston. For anyone, I don't know, what comes to mind for me is I wasn't involved in politics in 1974, was enjoying the high school life. I got involved in politics in 1992. But does anybody know the historical background of why everything else in terms of personal property was exempted and not a personal property of electric and pipelines, I guess? And,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wasn't I actually was involved in politics in 1974, but I wasn't paying attention to this. But, you know, to just be blunt about it. I mean, back then there was concerns with the state, with attracting companies to the state and not leaving the state for the Dakotas and Iowa and other places. And so there was we had this personal property tax that was a significant burden on our companies. And I think the repeal was simply to make the state a more attractive place to do business. You know, I can't say for sure, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the companies that continue to pay the personal property tax are those that can't pack up and leave.
Thank you. We've got another answer. Step forward, please, and identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Elizabeth Waifel. I'm a lobbyist with the firm of Flaherty & Hood. I represent the Coalition of Utility Cities. And I have tried to trace back this question. I haven't found all the answers on it, but some of what I found in some of the policy discussions is that part of it is because it has to do with the fact that it is an industry that's different than others. You know, I mean, it's good and bad that it can't pack back up, but it's also a regulated industry, as Mr. Brzezinski referenced. And so you look at actually how utilities are classified property tax-wise across the country, and they are sort of held out differently than other industries. And the fact that it is treated differently isn't that unusual. Other, you know, some states do it differently. The state of Wisconsin, for example, does it on actually the electricity that's being provided. But that's not that unusual. Another reason that's been suggested in some of the policy readings I've been finding is that simply that's really where the value in the plant is. I mean, these plants are located, they tend to locate them on rivers, for example, and it's very valuable property. But just a hulk of a plant right there, if you value it in the same way you might value something else, isn't going to have the same property. So to actually get value, you know, to actually make sort of it worth something on the property tax rolls, that's part of why they use the personal property tax. But it is because utilities are different. And again, it's Minnesota's not that unusual in treating, you know, things differently.
Thank you so much. Apparently I'm only one of the few people that's interested in this subject. Senator Howard, you just have such a way with bringing information before people. So.
Thank you. I think the excitement existed when this report hit the shelves.
Yeah, yes. Well, let's continue on. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. That's all the electric co-ops in the state. This proposal doesn't affect us as much as it does other utilities, mainly because most of our generation is located outside of the state. It does directly impact Great River Energy, however, and their refuse to energy plant in Elk River, and it would increase costs for them by about $1.7 million a year. As we've told Senator Howe previously, we, as a co-op, from our perspective, we believe that communities should be compensated for the additional costs and services required of hosting a plant. However, we just don't think this is the correct tool to do it. For example, Great River Energy has an agreement with the city of Elk River to pay them a fee every year that helps compensate that, and we'd prefer that approach.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Well, committee members, any other? I guess I can look to one side. Any questions? Senator Howe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to respond one other thing. The way that some of the utility companies and generating facilities are evaluated, it goes by the original cost of construction minus depreciation. I wish, as much as the complaints I've heard about the taxes on personal property, I wish my home could be taxed on the original cost of construction minus depreciation. Wouldn't we all love that?
Yes.
I can only speak from being the mayor of Red Wing and being close to the nuclear power plant down there. The assessed value or the taxable value has nothing to do with what the market value of that plant is. And then when you take off all the exemptions, you're looking at maybe taxing the plant at 13% of its actual marketable value. And for someone to say, that's too much, or we're being dealt unfairly, or this personal property assessment is unfair, I just don't think is a valid argument. You can show all the graphs and chart and show how much, and we can talk in millions and stuff, but we're talking about billion-dollar companies here that with revenues in the billions. We're not talking about millions. And, I appreciate if we can have that conversation about how local host communities should be compensated. But I think there should just be a fair tax structure, something that makes sense. When we talk about the class rate, what we didn't talk about today, I would in this bill that I have an amendment to take out, but I see we lack the quorum now to take it out. Section 2, I'm willing to take that out. Actually, I said I'd be willing to reduce the class rate if we had a fair marketable value on it. It is a significant burden. There's been a significant reduction in the taxable value as it pertains to the Department of Revenue valuation. The pollution control exemption, it's just one area. And if we want to do it, that's fine. I think there's another way to account for that if we want to encourage pollution control. I mean, most people or most plants probably do what's required by the EPA. But if we wanted to do something up and beyond what the EPA requires, there could be something there. Even if we wanted to do, the total pollution control. The fact of the matter is companies can be very aggressive in this, and that speaks to the transparency issue. And so, I think there are some recommendations in this report that we should consider. I don't think it has to be an either-or proposition. I think There's room for improvement. And I think I would just appreciate, you know, carrying this conversation forward. At least this is a start to have the conversation. And I think we do need to be very concerned about electric rates in our state. I think when it comes to businesses, we want to keep a very, very low rate. And I think there's ways that we can work together to get this done. So I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate everybody coming here and having the discussion. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Howe. I think we all realize that when we bring things forward as legislators, that does open a conversation. Sometimes it doesn't go the direction we think it will immediately, but it certainly impacts the future and kind of creates a way for that conversation to keep open. And it does definitely affect rates, but there's those other issues in terms of what goes on in the host communities and the potential problems, I guess, as we've talked about with nuclear and other things, the things you have to practice for.